This is Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast. Today we're talking about The Bear, just did its third season. This is Mark Lintonmeyer with a tragic backstory that will eventually be revealed in a flashback when really you just want the plot to move forward.
This is Al Baker, feeling very confident in my ability to critique the show, having eaten today half a bowl of cereal and a cherry Bakewell.
Nice.
Nice. Wonderful.
This is Sarah Lynn Breck. For my fine dining experience, my non-negotiables list includes no excuses and no cooked carrots.
I actually quite like cooked carrots. This is Lawrence Ware coming to you from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And my mom loved me in season one and season two, but she began to start questioning whether or not I was good.
I did get into a discussion recently based on the thing where Carmi is complaining about the guy who just doesn't want mushrooms. Like, is he allergic to mushrooms? No, he just doesn't like mushrooms. And the chef is affronted that I should be able to make whatever dishes and put whatever cooked carrots or mushrooms.
Yeah.
But my experience at the few times I've been at a really good restaurant is that foods that I normally don't like, if they're cooked by a master chef, I will like them. And cooked carrots and mushrooms are exactly the kind of thing. It's one thing if you just don't like cilantro and you're not just not going to like, you know, that whatever you have, that genetic predisposition. But if it's something like that, like just cooking it and using the right sauce, like, come on, you'll like cooked carrots, Sarah.
No, I won't. And I don't like mushrooms either or peas. I'm very difficult.
I love peas. I love peas. I do not like mushrooms either. Something about mushrooms.
Mushrooms are disgusting.
I think Mark probably likes it.
I have grown to enjoy mushrooms. Mushrooms I did not like to start. But now I will get like a mushroom burger even because I eat less meat. And if you rule out mushrooms altogether, that is a very limiting.
It is. But I have genuinely tried with mushrooms. It's something, I think it's about the texture. I don't know what it is. It throws me off. Can't do it.
Totally. Yep.
I think it's really interesting, Mark, that you brought up that scene. Because the story of the scene where Carmi is like giving everybody shit because someone doesn't want to eat mushrooms is that Carmi is dealing with the consequences of having set himself to higher standards when he was starting out with the new restaurant, which brings me to the show. Mm.
Thank you, Al.
A wonderful segue. Wonderful. Top notch, man.
No, just mushrooms for an hour.
The first season of The Bear, it was hands down the best new show that I'd seen in definitely years.
Unquestionably, yes.
And I expected when we came to talk about this show that all we would be doing is gushing about how wonderful this fantastically creative and original TV show was.
Thank goodness it will not be that boring.
Speak on it, Al.
This is the most interesting way that I've ever seen a TV show fall over in a later season. The third season of the show was frustrating in a way that was so surprising and seemed so unforced. And as much as I want to talk about what made the first season and to a lesser extent the second season of the show so good, I really feel like the most interesting thing to talk about this show is about how weirdly bad the third season is and why they did it.
I have all kinds of theories about it. I mean, let's just establish that first season, great. Second season, I think, honestly goes to a new level. I really like that second season quite a bit.
I agree. It was more conventionally satisfying, let's say that. Mm-hmm. Like, they're fixing up a thing.
Yeah, it gave them direction, purpose, whatever. It seems that when I look at the critical landscape, Jack Hamilton, who wrote that piece for Slate, I know him, he's a good friend of mine. I kind of have some quibbles with what he said, but Jack wrote a piece in Slate where he said that, I think he said something along the lines of—
Can I just give the title?
Yeah, give me the title.
The Bear is not a good show.
Yeah. I disagree with him on that point. Okay. I think The Bear is a good show. I disagree on that point. But this third season, I have so many theories about why it went wrong. I've read in some places that they had an idea for like how to conclude it, and they broke up the final season into twos. That kind of makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I heard also that they were overwhelmed by the love that the show got. And they kind of leaned on their stars. They had these stars. They didn't know they had the stars when they first started the show. They realized they had these stars, and they leaned on them to a certain extent. Maybe that's what's going on. I have so many theories about it, but I think it is universally understood that this third season was just not a success. It just was not.
Oh, no. But there's also a theory that when you have a successful show, third seasons are traditionally kind of hard. It's like You hit it out of the park.
It's usually the second season, though.
No, but the second season was so good. And that's mm-hmm. really hard to do as well. But they mm-hmm. now they have this momentum. And it's, you know, once you hit the third season, you know, beginnings can be really good, you know, and can be easier to write. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to kind of land the plane.
Certainly.
You know, and it just felt like they were just in this holding pattern the entire third season.
I'm going to trust Christopher Storer, the creator, and he wrote and directed most of those episodes that you're objecting to.
I agree.
Because once they got into the season and they said, okay, let's do a flashback episode and a childbirth episode, like those episodes were just as good. You know, they would have fit in the second season just fine.
And the Tina Napkins, I thought, was excellent.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the fact that nothing resolved, minor spoiler here, that the finale was dwelling on somebody else's restaurant and mm-hmm. it featuring, for some reason, a party that involved the guest stars from the other restaurant. And then our whole cast, who, as far as I knew, were not involved with this other restaurant. And so I don't understand I did not like the finale portion of it. But the rest of it, I think I had said this last week, maybe it was in our after talk, but just that I would have recommended to somebody just wait for season 4 to come out.
I agree.
And I think that this being the first half of season completely explains it.
Yeah.
Because I thought individual, you know, moment for moment, mood for mood, I still enjoyed the show a great deal. It just, of course, wasn't satisfying from a plot perspective.
I did come away from season 3 feeling like I had only watched half a season of television. So that explanation really does stack up for me too. But there are other things that I didn't like about the third season, other things which I think are maybe more serious problems. There's also the weird thing, which also speaks to the half season thing, where the episodes in season 3 were really short.
They really were. Yeah, unusually short.
We went from like 40, 50 minute episodes to 25, 30 minute episodes in a few cases. And that just felt odd and jarring, especially in the context of feeling like the show wasn't giving very much time for like plot to develop. There was a lot of it. It was always good to have focus on characters, but in the third season of The Bear, it felt like that was at the expense of the plot a little bit. But the bigger problem that I had with season 3 of The Bear was that it seemed to confuse itself about some things that previously the show had been very clear about, and I thought clear in a very interesting way.
Hmm.
One of the things I was most excited to talk about The Bear is that season 1 was the first time in recent history that I think I'd seen on TV a kind of unapologetic praise of excellence for its own sake. It felt like a very American dreamy show of a kind that you don't really see a lot anymore, because the kind of clear thing, the message running through the first season and the second one as well, was that if you focus on doing the best that you possibly can, if you focus on achieving excellence, then that is enough to inspire you and to motivate you and to bring you to get, like, to create a wonderful thing. And season 3, I think quite rightly, then turns to the question of how you deal with the cost of achieving that excellence. But it did it because it was very rushed. It felt like it did it in a very kind of ham-fisted way. That comes across very clearly in the last episode, where you have Sydney, who is unsure about whether she wants to work at The Bear or go somewhere else, and you have Carmi, who's remembering all of his like historical experiences working in these incredibly fancy, high-powered kitchens. Whereas in season 1 and season 2, the story of the show seemed to be focusing on like how achieving excellence in your field can bring, you know, motivation, togetherness, and all these wonderful things. Season 3 didn't seem to be able to land a clear message about whether or not that was worth the cost, or whether it was like, it's still worth doing, but only if you're doing it in a non-toxic way. It was confusing, I thought.
So I felt like in season 3, we really have this comparison between The Bear and what was the name of the other restaurant where they went to the funeral?
The French Laundry.
No, not the French Laundry. The one that was run by... Well, yeah, Olivia Colman. It was called Ever.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah. And how she has that actually kind of wonderful speech at the end of the finale. Spoiler alert. But she talks about how restaurants aren't really about the food, but they're about the people, about the experience. And Carmi has made it all about himself. He hasn't made it about the experience of going to his restaurant. He's made everything all about himself at the cost of his staff, at the cost of the customer experience, and it could be at the cost of the restaurant, you know? And Olivia Colman, and even though her restaurant closed, I think she closed it. Like it wasn't because they went out of business. I think she made that decision. And her restaurant was a success for not just herself, but also for her staff and also for the customers. And it was because she made it about the customer experience.
I thought that was interesting. I think that could have made an interesting dichotomy with what Carmi was doing with the Bear. I just think that the showrunners honestly were not interested in telling a total story, but rather setting up the second half of what they wanted to do. It's clear that this is going to have it's not clear. This better have a wonderful ending for the way that this third season went. Because I've seen shows, if you remember, did you guys watch Breaking Bad when it was like in the heyday and it was the zeitgeist, right? Mm. And they did that with that final season. They broke it up. They said, here's the first half of it. Here's the second half of it. For me, that worked. I mean, it was years ago. I was younger. I was not as intellectually astute as I am now. Mark is older, so Mark might have had a little bit more of a different experience with it than I did. But I really enjoyed it. Did you not enjoy it, Mark?
I don't remember the breaking up of the season specifically. I mean, when I did a rewatch of Breaking Bad, I just watched it all the way through. So I didn't have that experience of waiting 4 months or whatever. You know, I probably did at the time. It's been occluded.
If I remember, I think, didn't we wait like a year, Sarah?
They did that with Better Call Saul.
They did that with that too, yeah.
And I thought it worked.
It worked.
But it was because they closed some of the loops.
Yes.
They left some open, but they closed some of the loops during that halfway point.
And I think the issue with this one is that they didn't close any of the loops, right? They just left everything. Like, that speech that Olivia Colman gave was good. I mean, she's a good actress. That was good. But it didn't...
She's the best.
Don't go too far. Meryl Streep is still out there somewhere. Meryl Streep is out there in the wild somewhere. But it did well. It was a good performance. It was a good speech, whatever. But as far as the show was concerned, there was way too many things left open. So this third season was not terrible. It's not bad, I don't think, right? I don't want to go to this is the worst thing I've seen or whatever. It's not bad. I've seen much worse television, right? Like, if you think back to that last season of Game of Thrones, this is much better than what that was, right? It's just that we had such high expectations, and maybe it's our fault, but we have so high expectations for this show, such a high sustained level of, you know, greatness from season one to season two. We were so anticipating season three, and it was just a letdown. Like, it wasn't bad. It was just a letdown. And I have a lot of faith in the showrunner. I have a lot of faith in the acting and the direction. Like, the direction was fine. It was really good. I just need them to land this plane. And if they don't, I'm going to be very disappointed in a show that was really good for two seasons and ended up like faltering off at the end.
So Sarah Lynn, you framed the problem in terms of them not closing things at the end of the season. I think that's right to an extent, but also they have a problem with opening loops. Or rather, I think one of the weirdest things about the third season was that it was very unclear what the primary tension of the season is supposed to be throughout it. So there's a thing where, like, Carmi is burning through money at a tremendous rate, and there's not going to be enough money to keep the restaurant open.
Right.
It would have been, I think, really helpful as an audience member if there had been a few more scenes where there had been some maybe direct confrontations about that, more like real instances of Carmi's ambition getting like very clearly in the way of the success of the restaurant. It seemed like it was kind of skated over a few times. There's just like little piecemeal bits as hints at drama and at structured plot throughout the season. It's not even that they don't get resolved. It feels like they don't even clearly get set up all that much. And especially if you consider, if you remember the first season, where what's so beautiful about, especially that first episode, is you come away from it and you know exactly who everybody is. You know exactly what their problem is. You know exactly what they need to get over in order to be like good at what they're doing. And then the rest of the season is them like working through it and reacting off each other and growing like step by step. And you know where everybody is and you know where everybody's going at the beginning of the season. And then you get to see them get there. In season three, it felt like nobody was clear about what the core problems were. So everyone's right, the stuff that they've pointed to, like clearly the big thing is supposed to be like Kami setting these ridiculous standards and that's all getting in the way. But it felt like there are lots of missing scenes where people are trying to directly call him out on that, or like if that's the core tension of the season, have every episode directly bear on that and have some conflict and resolution which addresses that core thing. Again, they did in the first, I'll keep harking back to the first season, the core dramatic tension in the first season was that Kami cared and nobody else gave a shit. So the story was about how can I, Kami, make everybody else in this restaurant care about it as much as I do. And that happens over and over again. By far my favorite episode in the whole series is the one in season one where Tina and Sid develop their dynamic. And Tina finally unwillingly comes to respect Sid just because she finds herself with no choice other than to respect the talent and the passion that Sydney has. That whole arc was beautiful. And I just didn't see anything approaching that level of like clear character work in the third season. Apart from Tina's episode, which was also in season three, was also great.
Right. The pacing changed up. The formula changed up. I rewatched at some point the premiere episode of ER recently, which is another Chicago,
wow.
You know.
And wow.
It had that feel. It was like up all night, the things coming in. It's sort of like, it's exactly that tension that you got in the final episode of season two, where there's like this ordeal that you go through. And by the time the episode is over, you feel exhausted and the characters are all exhausted. And that's sort of, I think, a great thing that this show has done, but you can't do that every episode. I feel like that there's some storytelling difficulties when you're trying to be quite realistic. Like it would be very easy for this to become a soap opera in that there are enough characters and who's going to hook up and who's going to, you know, what's happening with their various home lives or whatever. And we get a little bit of that, but they're really trying to make it not satisfy us in the way that a soap opera would, such that we're not going to show, you know, if somebody's relationship is decayed, we'll just show that it has decayed. We won't show you how exactly. Maybe we'll have some flashbacks later when it's actually relevant to bring this in. You know, so once things get up and running, like there's just an ongoing tension. It's not like there's an adventure of the week. Oh, gosh, this time somebody has a birthday. We forgot the birthday. Let's make the episode all about how we forgot the birthday and what we're going to do. But like instead of just like mentioning that as a thing for one line in one episode. So as narratively unsatisfying as it was, I admire the effort to not fall into traditional narrative traps. And I almost want to say something meta about Carmi's self-indulgence is very much parallel to the Christopher Stover's self-indulgence in I'm going to tell this story visually and I'm just going to make, I know you want to know if he gets back together with his girlfriend, but I'm just going to show you more pictures of food and people, you know, doing the little pulling wishbones out of chickens, because that's what it's really all about, is about the little things and being in the trenches.
Let's stop for some sponsor talk. I want to tell you about Pop Pantheon. Every Thursday, DJ Louis XIV is joined by pop critics and superfans like The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino, Keepit's Ira Madison, and Bobby and Lindsay from Who Weekly to overanalyze all your favorite pop stars from the icons like Beyonce and Madonna all the way down to the lesser icons like Jessica and Ashley Simpson, and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon, a tiered ranking system that separates the queens of pop from the mere superstars. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
Everyone deserves to be connected. That's why Cox offers a range of high-speed internet plans that fit any budget. Stream, chat, and stay connected at an incredible price. It's fast, reliable internet for everyone. You're probably thinking, wait, what? But yeah, it's true. Learn more at cox.com/ACP. Non-transferable, one per household. Application and eligibility decisions are made by the FCC. Other restrictions apply.
You know, I actually loved the episodes in season two that were just focused on one character, because I thought they worked so well because they still drove the overall plot forward. So when Marcus was in the Netherlands and he was learning from the chef that Carmi cooked with, that was a beautiful standalone episode where we did get some deep character work. We learn more about Marcus. We all fell in love with Marcus in that episode, but it also drove the overall plot forward of him. He needed to be there in order to be part of this bigger experience. Same with Forks. Forks was also a beautiful episode. And Richie really, you know, in the span of a short amount of time, went from kind of a dirt ball to a guy who was appropriate to be in the, you know, at the front of the house. And he really had a full-on character transformation mm-hmm. just in a short amount of time, which is such a beautiful thing that the show can do sometimes. But it also lent itself to the larger plot of the that season's show. I think like with season three, as much as I liked Ice Chips, and I know not everybody liked Ice Chips, I liked Ice Chips. I loved Napkins. I didn't really think that it pushed the larger story forward in season three. And maybe it was because there wasn't much of a larger story in season three.
Was Ice Chips the first episode that was all in flashback?
No, that was the one about Sugar when she was having her baby.
Oh, yeah. No, that was great. But again, it was great as an individual character story. And yeah, had nothing really
to do with the plot of the show.
Is that Jamie Lee Curtis's best acting?
It might be.
She just makes you want to crawl out of your skin. And it's just so, I just didn't know she had those chops in her.
I love her in this part.
That episode was super important.
She's won an Oscar, guys. Come on now. Come on now. She's won an Oscar.
I think that episode was super important because it did a lot to address, maybe remedy is the right word, her first appearance, which was maybe a little overwrought. One thing I will say unflinching praise about the show, the way it handles mental illness is absolutely superb. Everyone is riddled with anxiety and depression, which is absolutely accurate. Everybody in the food industry is, most of the population are in general. But the way it portrays that on screen is absolutely stellar. But Jamie Lee Curtis's character, the first time she shows up, they say, oh, she has borderline personality disorder. And immediately that manifests in her driving a car through a kitchen wall, which is maybe a little
over the top,
a little much if what you're trying to do is give a grounded and sensitive portrayal of what it's like being a member of a family of people who with mental illness. But that episode in season three is really, that's, well, just all the speechifying they do to one another about what it's like to live with their respective ways of looking at the world and ways of feeling about the world is really beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. I also love that both characters seem to really finally listen to each other, including Sugar. You know, she was like, oh, you know, maybe this dumb breathing technique that my mom's giving me does actually help, you know, and it's, she can't just throw everything away about her mother. Her mother has a lot of really good qualities too, and they end up really bonding in that hospital room.
I want to defend that Thanksgiving or whatever episode from season two that I just think as a standalone piece, I thought it was wonderful. Just the way that it builds and the tension in that. And I thought the use of guest stars in that was great. Not like the John Cena one in season three, which was just gratuitous and silly.
Mm-hmm. I think we had too many of those, the facts. Brothers. I think we had a little too much. I like them, but in smaller doses, please.
You know, thinking about season three, the more I listen to you guys, it seems like we all agree that there are certain standout episodes. They just don't amount to a whole. And so there have been episodes like that in the past, like the ones that you've mentioned, Mark, the Thanksgiving episode. But there's been interesting standout, standalone episodes. It's just that those were more along the lines of contributing to a whole. So maybe what I will think about this season, looking back on it, is like a series of vignettes, like a really nice short story collection that maybe will come together in season four in a satisfying way. I'm just so hopeful they will pull this off. For example, there are high moments. One of the things that I was really taken aback, particularly this season, is the visual storytelling. It very much reminded me, the direction of the show reminded me of like a Brian De Palma at his best, right? Where Brian De Palma in the 70s, 80s, 90s to a degree, he's doing really interesting things with visual storytelling. He's not doing a lot of talking. Like, think about that shootout in the train station at the end of The Untouchables. It's very much a visual storytelling kind of way of directing it. And it's clear that this director, what's it, Christopher Storer, I think his name is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's very good at that, right? He's very good at that. It's just that this season felt like it was a little aimless. But in the individual vignettes, they're good. And so hopefully he'll bring that together because he's clearly playing with visual storytelling. And I'm very excited to see what he will do with that. I just hope that he will bring this all together in that final season. And as I said, and as we've all established, it's clear this is not a complete story yet. This is not the totality of what he wanted to do. I'm just really hoping he'll pull it together because there are really, really high moments in this third season. It's just that they don't amount to much. I really hope he pulls it together.
I think aimless is a very good word. I think really all the third season is missing is exactly that plot structure, that season-long plot structure.
Yeah.
The story that, as Sarah Lynn said, all these vignettes need to be wrangled in support of. In the first season, it was like, we've got to do something to save this restaurant. In the second season, it was, can we open the restaurant that we want to open? And just to kind of come back to the point I made earlier, which something Sarah said reminded me of again, it is weird because you mentioned, is it Forks, the one with Richie at the fantasy where he finds himself? In the second season, where you have episodes like that, and it's all about, again, about people finding motivation through excellence and through a desire to achieve standards for the sake of having high standards and how rewarding and liberating that can be. The whole of season two builds up to that, and then they open the restaurant. And then suddenly season three is like none of that ever happened. The show has completely forgotten that for two seasons it's been building up to liberating people through achieving high standards. And suddenly in the first episode, the high standards are immediately a problem. And what's deeply frustrating about that is that's clearly where the story of the show has to go. Once you've achieved the standards, you then have to talk about like the toll that takes, mm-hmm. whether it's worth it, the price you have to pay. It was very discombobulating to me to be immediately dumped into that milieu, having just come off the high of season two, which was all about bigging up the idea that achieving excellence can be liberating.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that in relation to fine dining, in relation to food. I've been going back and forth and watching old episodes. I watched Forks for the third time yesterday with Josh and cried again. But there's that whole montage. It must have been at the beginning of season three of hardworking, non-fine dining, you know, people who work in food in Chicago. And they did this in, I think, the first season as well, as they did a montage of just some great down-home kind of Chicago old standbys, you know, like this pizza place and this sandwich shop. And, you know, none of it was fancy, but it was all the ways that we feed each other and we nourish each other. And we went from a restaurant, The Beef, which nourished the community in which it's placed, which I think is in the near north area of Chicago, which historically has not been a fancy area of Chicago, into a fine dining spot. And I wondered, I've been sort of trying to wrap my brain around what this show is saying about fine dining and how it changes communities for good and for bad. I wondered if anybody else had thoughts about that.
Again, it's something that's kind of teased out around the edges in the third season. There's a little thing of like, oh, we've got to keep the beef sandwich window open. The regulars like it. It's where all the money's coming from. You know, that's the part of the business that really matters in a lot of respects.
That should have been its own episode.
It should. And this is exactly the problem. If you've got a 25 minute long episode that you're putting out, and the implication there is that you couldn't think of another 25 minutes of storytelling that would have enhanced the episode that you put out, that is exactly the kind of plot that would have been just a really brilliant way to hang a little bit of season relevant character development on. You can just have the episode all revolve around like Kami beefing, no pun intended, with like one of the other people, with Sugar or the surrogate dad figure, I forget his name, about the need to keep the beef window open. And that would have been a really wonderful exploration of exactly those kinds of themes, but they didn't. And I don't know why they didn't.
Kami beefing. Good joke.
Call me beefing.
And it's expensive. You know, like just that whole, I mean, it was funny when they were talking about, he and Oliver Platt were talking about the butter, right? Like that's funny, but it's also to change your menu every single day is expensive. I don't know how they could possibly sustain
that.
It's insane. It's insane to do.
And it's so wasteful. Like, none of the same ingredients. Like, that is, like, so stupid. Maybe this, you know, reveals my ignorance about fine dining. I really don't go out to fancy restaurants all that much.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
I mean, I don't know how anyone can do that, let alone a brand new fancy restaurant.
This again speaks to, like, the show being a little bit confused about itself, because in season one, if there had been a plot point about a butter shipment costing $11,000, the end of the episode would have been Carmi proving to everyone that it was worth spending $10,000 on butter.
Right.
But in season three, you don't know who was right about it. Just like, because I don't know. I don't know whether, like, new, where was it?
I think Oliver Platt had a point. Is,
right. We get Richie complaining about things not serving the front of the house. Mm-hmm. And we see in the back dishes getting sent back several times. And, you know, probably something that's pretty darn good, but doesn't quite fit your standards. Probably that person out there would be just fine with it. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. But we don't get to see, like, they just use a montage or whatever. Like, here's a montage and one of the Fact Brothers is spilling something on somebody. Like, make a thing out of that. Don't just have it in a montage. Like, how does the spilling or whatever it was fit into the overall service experience? I wanted to at least an episode about the service experience.
I just remembered there's this moment in the second episode where the show hovers for a few minutes around an allergy that someone's reported. Mm-hmm. And I was like, brilliant. Clearly they are going to set up a situation here where someone is going to get poisoned at a restaurant because Carmi was too distracted with his bullshit. So, like, but no, it just, like, they make a big deal about an allergy for a few minutes and then it just disappears.
It's a big nothing burger. You know, I am thinking, Sarah, because I didn't think about that initially, but I am now thinking that it is kind of playing with the idea of what happens when a restaurant like this is placed in a neighborhood that is not accustomed to this kind of neighborhood, because that would open the door to questions about gentrification. That would open the door to questions about economic inequality, right? Who gets to go to the restaurant, right? You have to drive through this lower income neighborhood. I honestly don't know much about Chicago outside of South Chicago, but that's the implication, I think, that this neighborhood is not very well to do. It's kind of a middle, lower income neighborhood. So you would drive through this lower income neighborhood, you go to this very high class restaurant. What does that do for the actual people who live there? That's a wonderful thing that they could have explored. They didn't explore it, not in any kind of meaningful way, I don't think. But that does open the door to interesting storytelling. I think that's very astute, Sarah, for you to bring that up.
Thank you. No, well, I think they started the conversation because
they started, but they didn't go very deep.
Yeah, they're forced to wait in line outside. And in Chicago, that's not a fun place to wait. You know, they used to be able to wait inside where it's warm, you know, and now they're not. And that's definitely a pretty obvious metaphor for something that they haven't been, I don't think, exploring fully.
They set up a load of good stuff that they could have paid off in earlier seasons with, you know, there's the old guys who are always hanging around outside and occasionally someone lets off a gunshot.
Yes, I was wondering about the mafia element.
Good point. Yeah.
Even just have an actual mafia element. Is somebody, when you're too successful in an area, do the people come by and lean on you? You know, is the Sopranos thing? Like, or is that not?
I cannot imagine the Sopranos showing up to the front door of the bear. I'm like, hey, go cut us in on that. What's going on? What's happening here? Come on. That would be a great show of television. Yeah.
I know this is not relevant, but, you know, just as that the part in the later seasons of the Sopranos when, like, they're trying to press on a chain store. And the manager is just like, I can't give you something out of the register. It's corporate. If you kill me, they're just going to bring in somebody else. Like that this kind of dynamic that, I don't know, maybe the bear is not as absurdist a show to involve things like that. Absurd enough a show. I don't know. Was there any play other than the Fact Brothers? Like, was there any play? This is supposed to be a funny show, and it seemed like it was sort of not.
They're not sure. It's in the comedy category for the Emmys,
this
right?
This season.
But it doesn't seem to know what it is.
That felt like a really cheap move to me. Put yourself in the comedy category so that you don't have to go up against real shows.
But that was because it was 30 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's a 30-minute show. Also, if they went in drama, wouldn't they would have been against, like, Succession last year? That would have been a disaster for them.
Yeah.
So going to comedy show, there's really no competition. Not really, not high level competition in comedy. not really.
Well, I guess if you cast comic actors, even if they're not doing comic things, then it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Is that the rule?
But Succession was hilarious sometimes, you know? Like sometimes Succession could be a bona fide comedy, but it was never categorized as that.
Honestly, I think Succession is hilarious to me. Like, it was laugh out loud funny 50% of the time. Yeah, I think you're right.
The best comedy, when it's at its best, is the kind of comedy that you find in Succession. Like, it's comedy that comes from people being completely at their wit's end and unable to cope with the situation that they're in. I think what is so immediately charming about the show is that you get thrown into these chaotic kitchen scenes. And it's the thing that everybody parodies about the show, right? Everyone, I've seen hundreds of TikToks of people in domestic kitchens like making mac and cheese and pretending that they're on the bear and shouting hands behind, all this kind of stuff. But that's the meme that has arisen from the show, and that's where I think a lot of the comedy comes from. And it doesn't often come from the John Cena-esque shenanigans.
No, that was way over the top. That was not a good. I didn't like that at all. That John Cena stuff, I could have passed on. That was unnecessary.
And I like John Cena sometimes, but he just didn't seem to really fit.
He needs to be used properly.
Right.
Like he's a very expensive piece of butter, and you can't just put him in a Kraft mac and cheese. You gotta use him properly. And they didn't do that.
Now, Lawrence, would it be completely out of line for me to imagine that maybe the reason John Cena is in the show at all is that whoever is show running hasn't quite got the cojones to tell John Cena that he can't be in the show once he's expressed an interest in being in it?
you might be right. I wouldn't listen. If John Cena said, "Hey, I want to be on your podcast," come on, man. Come on in. Whatever. Who cares if you're dry as hell? It doesn't matter. Come on in. Yeah, seriously.
The sacred dynamics of this podcast will not be defaced by John Cena's entrance. I'm
he
putting
can
my
come
foot
on
down.
In.
He
can
not come
on
the show.
I'm sorry. You guys talking about Succession made me think about Jeremy Strong. I'm the oldest boy. I'm sorry. That is hilarious. That is so funny to me. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
So what made Succession work is most of the characters were just monsters. And in this show, aside from, you know, Richie at the start of the show, and even then he was sort of a tragic.
Yeah, he was a tragic character. Yeah.
We're not sure what to make of him.
He always loved his daughter. That was always
his thing. Exactly. Now that we've really established that, then, you know, you're going to have some banter. Somehow Succession was able to have just basically absurd characters, but then get you to care about them. And they're just not going to do that in The Bear. These characters are just too solid and relatable, and they have family lives. And like, if Marcus is going to be occasionally slightly droll, you're never going to laugh at Marcus as a character. You know, you just can't. At the very worst, you can. Oh, somebody. You know, what's her name is too anxious, and so will sort of spiral in her. What's the character's name?
Sid.
Yes. So you can have sort of quirky things the way you might laugh at yourself. That's the way the characters can be laughed at by us. And that is so there's some firm limits to comedy, I guess. It has to be truly a situation comedy, not a character comedy.
Especially in the third season, the show started reminding me very much of, firstly, Ted Lasso, and secondly, BoJack Horseman. I bring that up now, Mark, because both of those cases, I think we also have similar kinds of characters, which the shows were nonetheless able to get, like, real genuine, I'm laughing at you, not with you, kind of jokes out of. So I don't know if it's necessary. Certainly, I think you're right insofar as they've set themselves a harder job to try and get comedy out of characters that they've also already, like, developed and fleshed out. But I don't think it's impossible.
See, I see the characters in both those shows as being more like the Succession characters, not in that they're monsters, but in that they are like sitcom sort of cliches, like, this is the guy.
They are.
And then you can say, hey, we're actually going to treat, you know, the wacky co-coach seriously and, like, get in that he has some. So, you know, they sort of erode the comedy as they went on. And maybe this is what went wrong with that show by the last season.
And then it stops being funny. Yeah.
Yes. But, and that's the same, you know, with BoJack Horseman, of course, they're literally cartoons. And even the main character is literally like a cliche sitcom character being sketched out, and you're just supposed to laugh at sort of the one dimensionality. It is a work of craftsmanship to find depth within the one dimensionality, but we're not getting that here. We're starting with just like people that you might know.
Yeah.
And, oh, isn't this crazy when, you know, this kind of person is in your life, and well, how do you feel about that? Like, I don't know. Yeah, it should be a drama. That's all there's to it.
Mm-hmm. Shouldn't be. Except for Joel McHale. Joel McHale seems like a pretty, even he's the bad character, and he's very much like a two-dimensional kind of bad character. Even, you know, and again, spoiler alert for the end of the third season, he and Carmi's big confrontation at the end just felt like any other scene I've seen of someone who is, you know, Carmi has let Joel McHale's character sort of control him, control his every move in the restaurant industry, even though he hates him. He can't seem to get rid of him. And what does Joel McHale say? Well, I don't think about you at all. And it's like, how many times have we seen that scene? You know, can we do something different here? You seem very intent on doing something different with this show anyway. I just wanted to see, I don't know, a better version of that. What did you guys think?
That was another really great example of how season three rushed itself, because we had had all these flashbacks mm-hmm. about Joel McHale all the way through the show. I think he's doing great at being that particular kind of asshole, incidentally. But the
I think so too. I love Joel McHale, but yeah, but it does. He is very much. Yeah, he's twirling his mustache.
He's been there through the whole show, but they haven't really at any point clearly set up how Carmi feels about Joel McHale, because, and again, to get back to the point mm-hmm. of excellence, Carmi, in the first two seasons, it seems to me that what the show was saying was that Carmi has put himself through a lot of shit, but that at least he himself clearly thinks that everything he went through was worth it because it made him great.
I felt the same way.
And then we get more of the stuff in season three, and then suddenly he has this confrontation with Joel McHale, and it's not clear to me when he decided that Joel McHale was abusive, much less when he decided that he needed to confront him about it. And again, I feel like there's just missing scenes.
Well, I think he's always felt he was abusive. Like, that was kind of the subtext in the earlier seasons that he felt he was abusive. But
I thought it was explicitly stated, like, very much.
Yeah.
That, like, yes, this is like that they're showing. I mean, he's not a very verbal character, Carmi. So, like, that's why they have to do all these flashbacks and all this just him setting things on fire while he's sleep cooking.
I mean, it was bad for him, right? And he knows that he's got, you know, we all can see that he's got some kind of anxiety disorder and he's got a bunch of like shit going on. But in terms of what he himself thinks about his past and his cooking and like and all the shit he's been through.
Yes, that's not clear.
Yeah.
I need to correct myself, because they did have whole scenes of him like basically in therapy or in group therapy saying, here's what is going on in my head. So he's not the Mandalorian.
No shade to the Mandalorian, a great television show. Don't start with me.
The Mandalorian the deleted therapy scenes. We didn't see those.
That must be a Robot Chicken sketch.
With a droid just sitting there, I'm like, beep, beep. Anyway, but the point, nevertheless, though, I'm sorry, but the point, nevertheless, though,
a Freud, if you will.
Yeah. Oh gosh, what is this? What is happening? I'm trying to make a serious point, Al. God dang it. The point, though, is that it's not fleshed out in his confrontation. Like, we don't fully know what he's thinking about this guy. The only thing we've gotten is that this guy is abusive, but it's clear that he has gotten something good from that experience at the mm-hmm. same time, and it's not well kind of defined in their interactions, but really good Star Wars jokes. Really good.
Now I'm picturing the Freudicas who roll in. Okay, go ahead.
Just pitching a slightly different way that scene could have gone. If we'd had one scene earlier in the season where Carmi had said, like, where Sidney had called Carmi out on some toxic bullshit that he was doing, and he'd said, well, I went through this and it made me better.
Yes.
And then in the second scene, he had a conversation with someone else where they made him realize, no, actually, that was abusive and you could have been great without that. And then you see Carmi maybe like talking to someone about how he's afraid to see Joel McHale and he doesn't know what he wants to say to him. And then there's some build up to this specific conversation. And we know how to feel when Joel McHale says, "I don't think about you at all." Because we don't know, like, are we expecting Carmi to be, what was Carmi expecting to happen in that conversation? We don't know.
That sounds like you would have been a wonderful writer on the television show.
Thank you.
I think you missed your calling.
But there has been so much build up to that. To that one particular scene that I didn't think it really paid off in the way that I know I was hoping. I mean, and also, you know, as far as trauma, you know, and this show in a big way is about trauma and how people deal with it or don't deal with trauma. I think Carmi both hates Joel McHale and he also seeks to be validated by him. He seeks his approval. And so everything that he does, that's why everything that he does is sort of in service to this memory that he has of him. So that's why he's been so obsessed with this guy. And, you know, and at that beautiful party at the very end, the funeral forever, he can't even enjoy it because he's been just so laser focused on Joel McHale, who's sitting like right over there. He wants to give him, he wants to tell him to F off and all of that kind of stuff. But I just didn't think the payoff was great. I was really hoping for something more.
Well, I bet Christopher Storer has been taking notes on this episode and all these scenes that we think they're missing. He'll just put them in the next season because when you're doing nonlinear storytelling, I wanted to see what you guys thought of that. Like, I think it's kind of ingenious. As much as I hate it on Lost, like, how are we going to keep introducing new characters? Well, let's have these two characters and just pretend they were there the whole time. And we'll have some flashbacks of how really they were there on the plane with everybody else. We just haven't shown them yet. They just were never in the background.
Oh my gosh. That was so irritating.
But we got, it didn't bother me in this show when they're like, you know, have the flashback to the people who used to work in the beef before Carmi arrived. And now we're going to introduce those characters as like, oh, we rehired them, or, you know, how they're introducing, like, that somebody has a husband or somebody has a sister or whatever, that they can retroactively insert these people who were not cast until this season as if they were there all along through the just incessant use of flashbacks. And I don't mind it.
That's totally fine. But the
John Cena was there the whole time,
but it has to be in service of something, right? If your weird flashbacks are in service of having John Cena in there for a bit part, then, you know, don't waste your time. Do something else. Like that, and that's why the opening was kind of confusing and frustrating too, because it was cool and I liked it. All of the food, it was the most food porny episode of maybe the food porniest TV drama that there's ever been. And there was a lot to like about it, but I did not know what it was doing there. And even after having seen the whole of the third season, I don't know why it opened with that episode.
Is this a good final topic? We really haven't talked about this show as food porn, which was like, if we talked about it in season one, that's a lot of what we would have focused on is just, I mean, has this influenced your, I know that, you know, we can talk about the memification and how people are trying recipe. For me, it's been, you know, I'm just not so into that world. So I really appreciate it on an artistic level. I feel like I'm being introduced to things, but it has no practical application to me. I don't know.
None whatsoever for me.
No. You know what the dish that I thought was made with, and I hate this term, made with so much love, because I don't believe anybody puts love into their cooking.
And when they reveal that Carmi had a rat under his
none of my dinners have any love in them.
My grandmother put love in every dish she made.
She did not, Lawrence.
I will fight you over this. No.
But anyway.
Just because you don't put love doesn't mean other people don't put love.
I was going to make a horrible joke.
Okay, all right. Believe what you want to
love
believe.
Equals wrath. Anyway, is that what you're going to say? All right.
That was just said. That's why it tastes so bitter.
Anyway, yes. But the omelet that Sid makes for Sugar in the penultimate episode in season two, I was like, that looks so good. And she saw a need and she fulfilled
with love,
it. And Sid got something out of it, and so did Sugar, you know? And I was like, that's what food is for. That's what that's for, you know?
It sounds like you just undermined your own argument just now.
Maybe.
There's that beautiful moment in season one where Sid's like early on there, and someone asks that Marcus asks her, are you going for delicious or impressive? And she says, delicious is impressive.
Yes.
That was a really great like statement. But my hot take about the bear is that I think the fact that it's about food is almost incidental. Mm. I think what's good about using food in restaurants is that firstly, food is something that everyone can like relate to. Everyone understands that the food they eat isn't as good as food can be. And everyone has this idea of like fine dining and what have you. But I think the real beauty of the show is in showing the blood, sweat and tears that it takes to make something as good as it can be and the ways that that is and isn't worth it. And in some ways, I think you could have a similar show doing that about almost anything, about people making a podcast or a TV show or writing a novel or being a janitor. Again, something slightly underexplored when Sarah Linney mentioned the shots they had of all the people who work in non-fine dining restaurants. Uh-huh. As all kind of, they were on the edge of a message there of generalizing the theme of taking pride in your work and how liberating that can be to people who aren't necessarily working in the fanciest places.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's always a possible branching structure to these shows of potential spinoffs or just a thing to explore in a particular episode of let's show some other restaurants. Let's show, you know, what this person did at their former job, what, you know, open up this person's family life. What is your desired spinoff? The one that's going through my head right now is like a company that makes the flakes that you feed fish, little fish flakes, and they're really into it and they're just like eating them themselves. And I really want to hear more about that. What do you want to... What's your favorite branching timeline?
That is a terrible idea. Terrible idea.
I want to see a whole miniseries about the Ball Breaker community and what they do after the bear closes.
Mm.
The arcade game.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That was a good sort of little subculture that was touched on. Give us your best shot, Lawrence.
I would like an entire spinoff about Carmine and his relationship to his Zen pouches. Because being related to someone who's chewed like tobacco type stuff to get over smoking, it's a whole ordeal, right? He's messed up his teeth. My dad did all kinds of stuff. I'm interested in like his relationship to those things. They're very interesting to me. Very interesting.
I just want a series of shows of people who think they can solve financial problems by borrowing a lot of money and then hiding it in cans. And that's better than doing anything else.
That sounds like some Guy Ritchie would do. That sounds like a Guy Ritchie movie, right?
You know, I think I'd like to see a show about selling old jeans, like, you know, this old denim market. Like, what's that about?
Which character was involved in that? I don't even remember now.
Carmi was selling jeans to pay the wage bill in the first season.
To buy meat.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, they will eventually reveal that this is all a Laverne and Shirley prequel, because if you remember Carmine Ragu, the restaurateur in that show, only Sarah is old enough to...
Do not know what you're talking about. No idea.
And then that would mean that he will have to sing in the upcoming episodes.
That's right.
when we get the musical, the music.
Is that a boomer joke? I think that's a boomer joke. Pretty sure.
No. Jazz a Gen X joke.
Anybody older than you does not become a boomer.
No.
It's a Gen X.
Gen X.
That's what
we're the forgotten generation.
True?
We forgot to talk about the soundtrack, which is entirely this dad rock stuff that is mostly exactly in my collection. Mm-hmm. Did that put you off, Lawrence?
Mark was rocking out. Mark was rocking out to this.
It got a little too expected as it went on. Like, oh, we're going to have another REM song. We're going to have another Wilco song. We're gonna, like, keep surprising
me. Is that more Pearl Jam?
You want a show set in Chicago that doesn't play a Seth Jen Stevens song every episode? What?
I was definitely thinking to myself, Mark loves this music. I was thinking to myself as I was watching the show, this is hitting Mark's spot, man. He is loving this.
But it's cool though, right, Lawrence? Isn't it cool?
No, it's not. No, it's not. It is not. No, it's not. It's boomerific. That's what it is.
All right. I will respond to that in the after talk. Folks, any final words here? I guess if you haven't watched The Bear yet, maybe you should check the show out.
I think
it's a pretty good show.
I do think you should watch it. I think that the filmmaking is really top-notch. There are some good individual episodes. The first two seasons are great. I just think they kind of lost their way in the third season, but I think they'll bring it home in the fourth.
I think it's still good. I'm still so excited for season four. I cannot wait for season four. And I love all of these characters. Yeah, it's a worthwhile show to catch up on.
We really haven't had enough time to do justice to how good the first two seasons were because we spent too much time griping about the third one. So if you haven't seen the first two, definitely see them.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop. Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network, and it's also presented by openculture.com.